I'm Sean Fennessy, and this is The Big Picture, a conversation show about The Godfather. Again, late last year, Francis Ford Coppola oversaw the release of The Godfather Coda, The Death of Michael Corleone, a reconfiguration of his film The Godfather Part 3, and the latest in a long line of director's cuts. What is a director's cut? What is their purpose? And what are the best in movie history? On today's episode, Chris Ryan and I will break down the truth behind International Immobiliare and why filmmakers...
International Immobiliare!
It's all coming up on The Big Picture. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. Are you tired of getting insanely high monthly bills from your wireless plan that includes unexpected overages? Well, here's a plot twist from Mint Mobile. For a limited time, their wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/bigpick. That's mintmobile.com/bigpick. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
This episode is brought to you by Sonic. You know what makes a good movie even better? Delicious food. And I know exactly where to find that. Now, for a limited time, you can get the new $1.99 Sonic Crispy Tender Wraps. A crispy chicken tender with bold flavors like hickory barbecue and cheesy baja, crisp lettuce, and melty cheese. It's just what you need for a perfect movie night. Get yourself some TLC, tender love and chicken, for only $1.99 at Sonic. Buy a $1.99 Sonic Crispy Chicken Tender Wrap today. Tax not included, limited time only at participating Sonic drive-ins.
CR, welcome back. How you doing, man?
Thanks for having me, man. I can't wait to do this.
It's really exciting to see you here. Have you finished your edit on the director's cut of that Philadelphia Eagles game from Sunday night? I was wondering.
No, United Artists has taken the keys to the editing suite. I've been locked out.
That's very sad. Speaking of sad losses, before we get into director's cuts, I'm not sure. Did you see the results of the 1995 movie draft voting? I'm not sure if you got a chance to look at that.
Congratulations.
Over the holidays. Thanks.
You know, I think that you're in good company with recent elections in terms of their stability.
I don't know. What are you referring to, Chris?
I'm totally sure. I hate the fact that if anybody loses these drafts, you're immediately forced into the Josh Hawley role. You know what I mean? Like, that's the company that you're keeping.
My electoral votes have been certified across the country, and I feel strongly about them. We don't need Mike Pence to intervene in any meaningful way. I am the true victor. Another true victor, Francis Ford Coppola, really one of the best ever, a hero of ours. We've talked about him quite a bit on the Rewatchables, talked about him a little bit here on The Big Picture from time to time. And there was an announcement late last year that he was reimagining, reshaping, recontextualizing the third Godfather film, which is frankly a much maligned movie. And we did an entire episode about it on the Rewatchables and our flawed Rewatchables short-lived series, which is one of the last pods that you and I did in person. I don't know if you recall that.
It is. Yeah, of course. Yeah. And it was also, I think, one of the more fun ones we've done, because sometimes flawed Rewatchables means only five people like this movie. But I think with the Godfather 3, we're talking about coming out of two of the most important but also most beloved films. You know, if you listen to the Rewatchables, there's a pretty good chance that Godfather 1 and 2 are in your top five movies of all time. And then there's a third movie that wouldn't be in your top 300. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's true. And it's not just a tacked on 90-minute movie. It's a massive two and a half hour film. So the idea of going back and recutting it and reshaping it, I thought was a fascinating decision. Not the first time that Coppola has gone back to the well with reshaping the Godfather story. Not the first time he's gone back to the well with reshaping one of his movies. It's something he is quite fond of. But just on the Godfather coda tip, when you rewatched when you watched this really for the first time, what was your initial reaction to it? Did you feel like it worked better than the film that we talked about a year ago on the Rewatchables?
Certainly. Although I think the fact that I saw the original version of it, or the widely understood version of it, so recently made it a complicated watch. One of the things I think will come up in this conversation about director's cuts is your relationship to the original film in the first place. You know, how often have you seen it? How much did you not like it that the director's cut somehow solved the movie for you, you know, and then there's a lot of tinkering that goes on. You know, this is ultimately an act of editing. And I think that that's only one element of what a director does. And I think sometimes when we talk about director's cuts, especially when we eventually will have to reckon with the Snyder cut, there's this idea that like he is going to like just go reshoot it. That he's going to take like $100 million of HBO Max's money and actually like fix all the shit that went wrong with it. That's actually not what happens with these movies. I mean, in the rare occasion, there's a ton of footage that wasn't used, but mostly what people are doing are speeding things up, slowing things down, reshaping performances maybe a little bit. With Godfather 3, you know, the freeze frame that you see, if you bought this on Amazon, there's like a freeze frame before you hit play, and it is a portrait from the ceremony that opens the original version and is now like happens in the second scene of the coda. And the center character who is in the middle of the photograph that is the freeze frame is Archbishop Gilday. And I think that really does prove that we thought for all these years that this was Michael Corleone's story. And it's actually The Godfather is actually about a guy who is a banker at the Vatican who meets this other guy and everything changes.
You know, for everybody who listened to that Godfather Part 3 pod a year ago, the biggest takeaway, I think, for all of us was your, at the time, I thought, inspired impersonation of Archbishop Gilday. And upon revisiting or seeing the coda,
little to do.
I have no idea what you were doing. And if you'd like to, if you want to revise that performance in any way, or if you'd like to do a kind of Chris Ryan coda on your Gilday impersonation. No?
No. I like the idea that there might be people out there who are like, oh yeah, that probably is how that guy talks.
Who've never seen the movie.
Yeah.
I think it's a very strange thing. I thought this was an interesting version of a director's cut because it does not resemble a lot of the types that we'll talk about, which is that a lot of times you hear that phrase and you think, you know, an additional 40 minutes of unseen footage, or you think completely reshaping the structure of the story or significantly changing the ending of a movie. That's something that happens a lot. You hear about studio notes and a filmmaker fighting back against those notes. In this case, and Coppola did a lot of press around this movie when it was released at the end of December, there are a lot of minor changes, I think, that help the movie, in particular that first change that you just identified, the fact that the film doesn't open with this ceremony of Michael Corleone's character granting essentially a $100 million gift to the Vatican. It starts with a business deal, with a conversation mm-hmm. between Corleone and Archbishop Gilday and the acquisition of International Immobiliare.
Yeah.
And that's really what the movie is about. It's really like a business movie. It feels very inspired by the machinations of studio business in Hollywood. It feels inspired by the increased globalization around the world. It feels inspired by the obvious real life Vatican business dealings, which we talked about at length on that Rewatchables mm-hmm. episode. And it just makes the movie make more sense to me. And even though that's a very minor change to just move one scene that happened 12 minutes into the movie right into the beginning, it actually, I think, in some cases accomplishes what Coppola sets out to accomplish, which is he's just made a different movie. And I was kind of impressed by how powerful that could be. Now, as the movie went along, I had a harder time identifying what it was that he had changed. Did you feel comfortable picking out and choosing and saying, oh, this is different, that's different?
No, I mean, that was actually quite difficult. I mean, I think the opening and the closing are the ones that you are obviously alerted to because they're so significantly different. And the opening, I completely agree. You know, the original scene with the ceremony that Michael is having, I think, is supposed to really obviously echo the Lake Tahoe and New York openings of the first two films. But just setting it up, I mean, even this is like having George Hamilton in an early scene kind of fixes, not, it doesn't fix the absence of Robert Duvall, who I think would have helped this movie enormously, both just even in the writing for that character and having the Tom Hagen character exist in this world rather than as like a footnote with this young priest played by John Savage. But even just having George Hamilton, you're like, oh, okay, so Michael has a new lawyer now. You know what I mean? Like little things like that that you just intuitively understand from that moment, and also the enormity of the deal that he is trying to execute, and the fact that he's going from not just like a thug or a guy who has got some pieces of casinos, but to becoming, you know, a Bertelsmann, a Seagram's, like a huge family owned conglomerate, is like incredibly crucial. And it makes a lot more sense in terms of his desire to reconnect with his kids, because he understands that this is his legacy that he's going to be passing down. If he buys this company from the Vatican, it will be generations of Corleones after him that sort of oversee it.
Yeah. And, you know, much like your Eagles, Michael doesn't really realize that he has forfeited his chance at legitimacy by by murdering the integrity of the game.
Yeah.
And the movie, I think, is...
So is Joe Judge Fredo here? Is like, who's Fredo?
Yeah, probably the Mara family is probably a slightly more reasonable comparison. But I think that it's the kind of movie where I want it... I've always wanted it to be better. Mm-hmm. And so this gives me an opportunity to think it's better. And I'm having a hard time kind of wrapping my head around whether it actually is better. What I see more, much more so, and you just hinted at this, is the heavy echoes of the first two films in this version, and the intentionality of sort of, you know, revising and repeating the same themes and the same ideas and even the same like visual images that he created in those first two films. The thing that the film was probably most significantly criticized for when it first came out was the performance of Coppola's daughter, Sophia, as Mary, who is Michael Corleone's daughter and mm-hmm. the love interest of the Andy Garcia character. And there's been a lot of conversation over the years about, you know, just how unskilled an actress people thought she was at the time. And now she has gone on to become such an important filmmaker that there's a complicated conversation around that. I will say, and I felt this when we revisited the movie a year ago, but even more so now, I don't think that the performance is good by any means, but I also don't think it is like the train wreck that it has made out to be over the years. But I also couldn't specifically tell what was reframed here. Was it clear to you how he
I think that there's
this?
Less of her. I think he moves through those scenes a little more quickly. I think the gnocchi making scene, which is sort of notorious as like the kind of Nate Nadir of the entire saga, is I didn't take a stopwatch out, but I think that some of those scenes move through more quickly. And I think generally there's a little less of her. I found that plot line specifically this time around, I don't know, maybe it's because we watched it so recently. I thought that was very clear. I thought that entire, like, Vincent falls for Mary. Vincent also rises in estimation in Michael's eyes. The moment comes where Vincent is pegged. He's chosen to take over as godfather. And the price for that is to give up Michael's daughter for both incestuous reasons and also because Michael is trying to inoculate Mary from whatever comes at Vincent once they return to New York, and that Vincent quickly acquiesces to that, you know. And I thought that there was a feeling of narrative clarity for me. I think the Immobiliari stuff, and specifically the stuff in Italy where all these different assassins and dons are getting involved, I think is still really cloudy to me. I know I could probably like sort it out, but you know, I think there's a bit of the ending that still is, he's just so enamored with this idea of ending it with this operatic code, like aria, that it kind of abandons like everybody getting all the plot points totally making sense.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the final 30 to 40 minutes, on the one hand, is this, you know, impressive feat of intercutting and
Gilday,
telling the story.
Like falling down the stairs and like, yeah, you know,
there's
it's
amazing
gorgeous.
Stuff, but it's also really, it's still quite drawn out and it feels, you know, incredibly melodramatic and over the top, but it's not bad. And, you know, I think the things that worked for me the first time still work. I think this is an unbelievable Al Pacino performance.
Yeah, and we focused a lot on that in the rewatchables. I would also say I thought Garcia this time around, like just watching Garcia this time, it among the first times that I was ever like, if they had made a Godfather 4, I think that would have been cool. Like, you know, I thought his performance has a real texture to it this time around. For maybe it's always there, but I just really noticed the way he changes over the course of the movie.
What do you think about Coppola's relationship specifically to returning to his totemic work and trying to revise it? Because he's somebody who doesn't really need schmucks like us to come and explain why his stuff is good. You know, he's made three or four of the most important films ever, mm-hmm. and yet he can't resist this urge to revisit. What do you think?
I think
that?
It gets to the larger conversation about director's cuts in general, because the defining tension of Coppola's career is his desire for creative control. He starts his own studio. To do so, he invests millions of dollars of his own money, often leveraging his own real estate, his family's wealth, to finance movies that are passion projects of his. And then he will go off and make a Rainmaker, or go off and make you know, not a studio picture, but I think obviously remaking Godfather 3 was clearly a gambit for him to have creative freedom going forward. He's one of these guys that I think is the person who proves the director as author rule, the auteurism rule. And we're saying director's cuts here. We're not saying the Thelma Schoonmaker cut. We're not saying the Walter Murch cut. We're not saying the Paul Hirsch cut. It's always the director's cut. It's like the director's vision of this movie. And Coppola is the proof of that. Like Coppola going back and tinkering with Apocalypse and tinkering with Godfather movies and re-editing Godfather movies. And I think maybe the more significant reimagining of the Godfather movies is the chronological cut that has been released a couple of times over the decades, but if people haven't gotten a chance to watch the movies that way, it's quite an experience to watch them sort of go from young Vito arriving in America through Robert De Niro into the Pacino era with Brando. And he's going to fix Wolves. I don't know. He's always messing with it.
Yeah. It actually reminds me quite a bit of the Hackman character in The Conversation. You know, he can't look away. He can't not listen. He can't not tinker mm-hmm. with understanding why something happened the way that it happened and try to, I don't know if fix is necessarily the right word, but constantly reimagining his own creativity is that must be a nice place to be. You know, obviously Francis Ford Coppola is hugely successful and wealthy and has everything in the world, but it does feel like he has, in addition to being an author of his work, he's like a creative constabulary. You know what I mean? He has a level of oversight into his work that is uncommon. You know, it seems like he understands what his place is in film history. I've been rewatching a couple of his movies recently, and you can see this even in movies like Tucker, A Man in His Dream, and Bram Stoker's Dracula. He has this really complicated relationship to the thing that he made, and it feels like a constant, you know, essentially he's not able to put exactly what he wants on screen, and mm-hmm. he is tortured by that at all times. And I it's think fascinating.
The flip is also that he's the guy at the blackjack table who doesn't even feel anything until he's down 2,000. I think that there is a degree to which he needs the feeling of Robert Evans kicking down the door, demanding that he finish the script or get the edit out or make sure that, you know, there's some people who need that chaos and that pressure to perform. And really all of his successful films have come through the fire. They're not the ones that he gets to go off and make his quiet passion project. It's the one where there's this collision between art and commerce. And that's really that's the germ of what this conversation is about. The director's cut is this idea that I was not able to put out the thing that I wanted to because a theater needs to turn over its screen 6 times a day. So we want to keep this under 2 hours and 25 minutes or something.
How many times after you've finished recording a podcast do you think, I need to go back, I need to recut, I need to revise?
I'm not a tinker. That's not like, do you ever feel like, do you immediately start thinking about things you could have done differently?
Never. I think about our pals, Mallory and Jason, all the time in Binge Mode, and the kind of effort and clarity and the length and the amount of time and work that goes into making their show relative to our show. And I feel like all of my work happens before. Mm-hmm. Everything, once I have started talking, and obviously what we make is infinitely less interesting, important, or useful than The Godfather, but just as a means of communication, as a means of making anything, of putting anything out in the world, I think I'm a lot like you, which is I may have some regrets, but I just have to go to the next thing.
I'm a volume shooter. Yeah. It's like some are going to go in and some are going to go out.
Truly. Let's talk about director's cuts a little bit more specifically, because I think you put your finger on the thing, which is that it often feels like this battle between art and commerce and studios and people telling artists that they know better or that they know how to make something more profitable. That's not always the case, though. And some of these films that we're going to talk about and some of these approaches are a bit more esoteric, mm-hmm. are a bit more unusual. In some cases, they mean cutting back, not cutting more into the frame. So I've identified it what feels like about 6 different types of director's cutters that you come across here over history. The first is probably the most significant and the one that we think about most, and I think most closely dovetails to what you're describing, which is the unshackled, mm-hmm. the filmmaker whose vision was muted or muffled by a big studio at some point, and that they have been given a chance or have sought to get the chance to tell the true story, to make the movie that they always wanted to make, or at least that they felt that they had captured. And there are a lot of historical examples of this. Heaven's Gate is probably the most, if not legendary example, probably a notorious example of this.
Sure. And it has an actual book about it called Final Cut.
Yes. And this is Michael Cimino's 1980 movie. This is the film he made after The Deer Hunter that reportedly sunk United Artists, the studio, and also reportedly sunk the New Hollywood and the era of the, essentially the auteur being in charge of the creative process in Hollywood.
I think Mark Harris had this great piece about Joan Micklyn Silver, who just recently passed away on The Vulture. And he was writing about how she had a movie with Griffin Dunne and the guy who played Niedermeyer in Animal House, I'm forgetting his name, and that like United Artists had backed it, like, we got Heaven's Gate coming, so we're good. We're just in the business of making great art. And Heaven's Gate collapses, and United Artists winds up turning it into this kind of like horny comedy, you know, and like put like a Griffin Dunne with a like, oops, movies, like poster. And so, yeah, it certainly ended something there.
Yeah, it's and that's a great reflection, I think, of what a movie like this can do. You know, they can be blamed for the destruction of other people's careers and other people's projects. They can be blamed for the destruction of the creators' careers. You know, Cimino was really never the same. He did make more movies after Heaven's Gate, but you know, that's a movie that's it's a 3.5 hour Western about the Johnson County War. I revisited it recently. There's an edition on the Criterion Collection, and it's hard to imagine a version of that movie that is 2 hours or 2.5 hours, like the one that was released after the original version was pulled very quickly. But this happens over and over again. You know, we've seen it with movies like Brazil. I mean, your guy, Ridley Scott, you should talk about Ridley Scott's relationship maybe to the director's cut, because he maybe has more than any filmmaker ever.
Yeah. I mean, I would almost say that that is seemingly baked into the Ridley Scott experience. And one thing that we should note is the emergence of the idea of the director's cut and the home media market, you know, and now we could call that the streaming market, but just the idea that people would own movies at any point was only like something that happened in the 80s, really. Like, you know, I think that people had their own private collections of films, and you know, there were ways in which you could own a movie, but for the most part, people would go to rep theaters if they wanted to see older movies, or they would watch them on television. And sometimes, in the case of The Godfather, and he did special cuts of The Godfather that aired on NBC. But for the most part, like, the movie you saw in the theater was that, and then you probably didn't really get a chance to see it that many times afterwards unless you went and saw it in theater. And then in the 80s, in the home video market and the Laserdisc market and the DVD market starts, and to sell new iterations of this DVD, to find a guy like you, Sean, and say, I'm going to make you buy Alien or Blade Runner 5 times in 20 years. They have to tweak it somehow. And you can't always just say, we've like kind of cleaned up the image a little bit or punched up the sound a little bit. Like, you have to entice people with the idea that this version of the movie that they're going to see is somehow new. And Ridley Scott, who's one of Hollywood's most successful filmmakers of the last 30 or 40 years, is the person who I think has the most significant amounts of director's cuts that actually wind up changing how you feel. The other people in that list, though, are not unsuccessful directors. I mean, Cimino is almost an outlier in the sense that his career completely collapsed after Heaven's Gate. But you've got guys like James Cameron, Steven Spielberg, like very successful directors who often will be like, yeah, well, there's a different version of Aliens. You know, there's a different version of Close Encounters.
Yeah, it's so that actually raises a question that I wanted to ask you, which is, do you think that these people do feel creatively crunched, or do you think that they are dramatists and are frequently kind of inventing enemies to feel bound by and have to rebel against? You know, like, you don't have to make a clinical personality judgment on Ridley Scott necessarily, but a lot of the time, maybe Terry Gilliam is a better example of this, because you know, his version of Brazil was notoriously cut by Sid Sheinberg, I believe at Universal at the time. And Terry Gilliam is a dyspeptic and defiant artist and filmmaker. And it always feels like he's in some sort of battle for his own personal freedom or his own idea of freedom. And I have often thought Terry Gilliam is, of course, a genius and has made wonderful movies. And I love Monty Python, but it does feel like he is waging a war for his own reputation rather than for a film a lot of the time. But I don't know. I mean, there's so much that is unknown and unseen about this. Do you think that people that fall into this category are like essentially telling a story of their own persecution in an attempt to valorize themselves.
I certainly think that there's basically two kinds of director's cut directors. There are showmen who know better, and then there are rebels who kind of like going down with the ship. And the latter, you know, they can have overlap in terms of their personnel, but you see people like Gilliam. There's the famous story of the director's cut that no one will ever see, which is the 4-hour version of All the Pretty Horses that Billy Bob Thornton made with a Daniel Lanois score that Matt Damon claims is one of the best movie he's ever made and could have been like one of the great American movies, and was mangled by Harvey Weinstein, and then a different soundtrack was put on it. And Daniel Lanois will not release his own score to have it remastered or redone. Like, you will never see that movie. So there's people like that. There's people like, you know, you read like diaries from like John Borman as he's like making movies. And like, it definitely seems like John Borman is like, I want to make a King Arthur movie that's just like a sexual fantasy about this. And then you're like, you're not going to be able to make that movie, man. You know, like, I don't know if you thought you were going to be able to make that movie, but you're not. Like, there are some filmmakers who I think are willfully putting their head in the sand about the realities of the business. And then there are people like James Cameron, who's like, I had a 15-minute part at the beginning of Aliens. We took it out. Turns out it's a better movie.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think that Cameron probably falls a little bit closer to the second category here, which is like what I'm calling the fiddlers, you know, the people who kind of can't stop playing with their toys. And you mentioned Spielberg. I think Spielberg is an example of that too. People who make quote unquote perfect movies, you know, Close Encounters of the Third Kind is a perfect movie. Aliens is a perfect movie. And nevertheless, we still get reimaginings. I have noticed, and I don't know if you've noticed this, but I have noticed online that a lot of people were rewatching the Lord of the Rings movies over the holiday break.
Actually, because they go on the marathons on TNT, but I don't know why everybody got the message to do this. Yeah.
I don't know either. I know Mallory Rubin just rewatched like all the extended editions, and this is the thing that was just, you know, the 4K release recently came out, and there are these massive, long extended editions of the Peter Jackson films. I love those movies. I think those movies are fantastic.
But there was a point where they were putting out a new version of those movies every like 18 months.
At least it felt like it. Whether that is actually true or not, I don't know, because I'm not closely tracking what they're putting out into the world or if it's meaningfully different. And that's the thing, even just researching to have this conversation with you, it's kind of tough to identify what isn't new. I think that's true for some of the Ridley Scott stuff too. But, you know, for somebody like Cameron, or probably most notoriously, for Oliver Stone and Alexander, there are like 4 extant cuts of Alexander, his epic tale starring your boy Colin Farrell. And that's an example of a movie where I can tell what's different, because there's like 20 to 40 minutes of padding on it. But for Close Encounters, for example, the cuts are not that different.
There's a version of Close Encounters where you don't see inside the mothership, right? Right. And when that was a significant thing that Spielberg basically offered to shoot and did shoot, and then was like, God damn it, I shot that, and now they're going to use it because this is the most sci-fi blockbuster part of this movie, is to be able to see inside of an alien ship. You know, I think it's interesting that you're bringing up the idea of like comparing and contrasting the theatrical versions of the director's cuts, because for a lot of these, I don't think that you really notice that much. You know, if anything, some of them feel a little shorter. Like, you know, Spielberg is gone in, I think, made Close Encounters a little bit shorter in places. Blade Runner is a very good example of a movie where the version that was in the theater and the version that Ridley Scott, his sort of final cut, is pretty significantly different tonally, but is not actually that significantly different in terms of runtime. You know what I mean? Like, the absence of the voiceover makes a huge difference when you're watching Blade Runner. Although, I'm curious how many people have seen only the final cut version of Blade Runner. You know what I mean? Like, watching the final cut version of Blade Runner, it's nice to not have the voiceover, but I don't know how much Blade Runner sometimes makes sense if you don't have the voiceover.
Let's hold off on that, because I think we'll talk about Blade Runner a little bit more in the future, but it's a good question. I think understanding the difference requires a level of obsession that might even elude people like me and you, which is part of the reason why I wanted to have this conversation. You mentioned Zack Snyder.
Yeah, I did.
I think Zack Snyder falls into the third category, which is the Justice Seekers.
Is the greatest filmmaker of all time, right?
What'd you say?
Release it. release the Snyder Cut?
They are releasing the Snyder Cut, and fans of Zack Snyder and ostensibly fans of his version of the Justice League, which we have not seen, want justice. They want justice for the version of the movie that they believe should exist. There is a version of this that I think is slightly less, I don't know, toxic or controversial in Superman 2. Superman 2 famously filmed concurrently with the original Superman movie. This is the Richard Donner movie, and was functionally taken away from the director Richard Donner and Richard Lester, the famed director of Beatles films and one of the great English directors, took over. He was acting as kind of like a consultant slash producer and was friendlier with the studio. And he made a version of Superman 2 that is a bit goofier and even more kind of like slapsticky, I would say, than the original Superman movie. And about 20 years ago, Richard Donner was finally granted the opportunity to recut the version of the film that he wanted to make, which includes reinserting Marlon Brando into the film as Kal-El's father. And Brando was cut out because he was having a war with the studio, and removing some of the conversations between Kal-El and his mother. And, you know, Donner got to have his final say, I guess, on this film. And that was perceived as justice. It's weird how much that controversy foretold, I think, a lot of the weird conversations that we have about superhero movies in 2021, where we think that there has to be a definitive version of a kind of film as opposed to seeing things in the multiverse. Have you looked at the Richard Donner cut of Superman?
Yeah, I haven't done so in a long time, but it's certainly a different movie. It's a lot less slapstick, a lot less. And with comic book movies, you know, the lines are really fine between that kind of almost self-consciously, like, it's pretend, it's supposed to be fantastical, versus like, no, this is actually a lens through which to look at really human experiences, you know?
It reminded me a bit of the Rogue cut. Do you remember the Rogue cut?
Yeah.
For X-Men Days of Future Past.
Yeah.
Which was like an entirely different version of the film that featured a storyline with Rogue, because Rogue is barely in Days of Future Past.
I still can't explain the Rogue plot line of that movie.
No, me neither. Yeah. I also can't explain how they screwed up Days of Future Past. Truly one of the best comic book storylines of all time, and an utterly mediocre movie. Deeply disappointing.
The Justice Seekers thing is like, this is the hashtag era. This is sort of the idea that fans can will the version of the movie that they want into existence. And I think the first time we really saw this was a little bit of around Last Jedi, where I felt like people kind of were like, you ruined it, and now I want JJ to fix it somehow. And in some ways, the final film and the sequels was sort of a corrective for Last Jedi. And this idea that there is like a base that you have to appeal to, and that if you don't, they can kind of just demand a better version of something than exists.
Yeah, that's a very odd tick of the internet that has come along in the last 10 years and probably isn't going anywhere anytime soon. And we're about 3 months out now from the Zack Snyder discourse starting once more, which I look forward to you joining us on the show to talk about Justice League, which I know
we should start
really
getting into like really random cuts. You know what I mean? Like, I'm trying to think of like release the Clive Owen cut of The Informer, you know? Like,
yeah. Well, that does feel like a movie that is missing 40 minutes of Clive Owen's character. So I would watch it. I would definitely watch it. Another kind of cutter. I think the apostate is a really important version of this. And I can only think of one example, but it's an important example. And this is George Lucas turning on his own religion and revising and adding digital creatures, characters, fixes to Star Wars. In 1997... Let's just talk about the 1997 re-release of the Star Wars movies, okay? This was a pretty big deal. I was 15 years old. This was an opportunity for me to see Star Wars movies in theaters. Let me tell you, it was phenomenal. I was just so excited. Yeah. I grew up being obsessed with Star Wars from the age of 3 to today. And the chance to see them in that re-release was a huge deal. Now, I don't think I had a total understanding at the time of what it was that Lucas did to sort of quote-unquote improve those movies. Among them, adding new creatures, using digital animation technology to, you know, show the worlds in the way that he wanted to show them.
Goosing the sound with like new THX, you know, technology or whatever. Yeah.
I believe also Greedo shooting first was amended there.
Speaking of hashtag cuts. Yeah. The Greedo cut.
As I recall. And it was very exciting, but it was probably my first taste of rejection by a fan base. Mm-hmm. You know, that felt like, and this was early days of the internet, and it was early days of fan culture and the way that we understand it now. Did you excitedly go see the Star Wars?
Yeah, and then I immediately went to Ain't It Cool News message boards.
To complain or to write your 10,000-word scribe?
To my 10,000-word Greedo defense. I remember going to these movies, and my dad took me to like an 8:30 a.m. screening of it, and I fell asleep. You know, I think I had like, it was almost like a sugar high where you kind of built up all this anticipation to see it. And then I realized I had seen these movies 300 times. And I was like, oh yeah, like I just saw New Hope like 6 months ago. I don't know if this really matters that much.
Wait, were you reading movie magazines at the time? Did you believe?
I think I was reading Premiere and Movie Line and stuff like that.
Did you believe Lucas's
American
lines?
Cinematographer? I was reading in 1997.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Of course. Me as well. I was contributing at that point too to the magazine. Did you believe his line about essentially this being the vision that he always wanted to put on screen? Or did you think this is a cynical cash grab?
With Lucas, it's kind of hard because he's at once the most cynical cash grabber, but also like, how does a guy even have more money than that? So
yeah, he's so po-faced too, you know, like you never feel like he's being
I actually think he sincerely is like, I'd like to tinker a little bit more and show more of like the Senate, you know, more of the like the Galactic Senate.
Yeah, we need the Senate cut, I think, of Phantom Menace too. That's something I've been thinking about, just more of the inner workings of the chamber.
Senates are great.
One of your favorites, this is not really an official version of director's cuts, but It is becoming increasingly common, and I think one of our heroes, Steven Soderbergh, is foremost in this category, which is like the unofficials.
Yeah.
So Soderbergh notoriously recuts people's films all the time.
Shout out to his seen, read, and watched list came out today. We're talking on Tuesday.
Have you had a chance to look at it?
I have. Yeah. Just always feel really bad about myself. Because even when like I'm like, oh, I can keep up with him in certain departments, it's like he still read 50 books and watched Chinatown 3 times in a week just to like chill out, you know.
Let me pick a random day here from his list just to identify the greatness of Steven Soderbergh. April 6th, The Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant.
Yep. Fassbender.
Peter Greenaway's The Draftsman's Contract. And holy then shit. Below Deck Sailing Yacht.
Yeah. What is Jules Asner doing? Like, do you think that she's ever like, do you want to come have like a glass of wine with me? Are you busy?
They're watching it together.
You think Jules Asner watch? I think Jules Asner is like, get that Greenaway on the screen right now. It's time.
Yeah. They're like Marvin Schwarz and Mary Alice Schwarz in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You know, they sit down in their screening room, pours a nice cognac. You know, she loves a Western, and then she leaves, she goes to bed, and he watches the 14 Fists of McCluskey. You know, like I bet they have a beautiful relationship. Anyhow,
I'm sure they do.
Soderbergh, in addition to watching everything in the known universe, also sometimes edits everything in the known universe.
Yeah, he does his own cuts.
And, the one, you pointed this out to me years ago when we were working together at Grantland, the black and white cut of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And
it's a silent cut with the Social Network score over it. And I think, I don't know what the exact quote is, but I think Soderbergh considers Raiders to be cinematically like a perfect movie. If you want to learn how to make movies, you should just watch it. And if you watch it without dialogue, you can still understand everything about the movie.
He's done this over and over again, though. He cut Heaven's Gate in half. He did like a 90-minute cut. Yeah. Yep.
That's not available anymore.
Yeah. Oh, you went looking for it?
I did, yeah. I mean, I'm sure it's somewhere, but it wasn't on his site, which I think Raiders still is.
I mean, he's recut 2001. Like, he is unsparing too. Like, Raiders in 2001, two of the most acclaimed films of all time. And I think just the idea of experimenting with what a movie could be by redefining it is sometimes better in the hands of someone who didn't make it. And I like that idea. I like the idea of someone reimagining someone else's creativity. But you've cited an example here on our outline of someone who did that, that I've not had a chance to see. What did you write down?
Topher Grace re-edited the Star Wars prequels, I think, into one movie, if I remember correctly. This is a product of like a better, cooler part of the internet, of when I think there was like a little less like copyright oversight and people could do weird shit like this and upload it. And you kind of be like, oh, wow, look at that. And like, the idea of Topher Grace just sitting up in the Hollywood Hills on like a throne made of that 70s show money and re-editing the prequels is really entertaining to me. But yeah, these kinds of gambits, I think, are going to get increasingly hard as streaming libraries become more and more like these walled off. This is our intellectual property. We don't want this existing on YouTube. We don't want this existing on Vimeo. We don't want Topher Grace doing a non-Disney Plus cut of movies where, you know, when people could be paying $9.99 a month to be watching them.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Okay, Sean, top three movie snacks of all time, go.
All right, let me think. Popcorn?
Obviously.
Ice cream?
That's two.
Oh, and Reese's Peanut Butter Cups, of course.
Peanut butter and chocolate is a pretty perfect combination. Some may even say the ultimate movie snack.
You can't argue with that.
Find Reese's now at a store near you.
This episode is brought to you by Sonic. You know what makes a good movie even better? Delicious food. And I know exactly where to find that. Now, for a limited time, you can get the new $1.99 Sonic Crispy Tender Wraps. A crispy chicken tender with bold flavors like hickory barbecue and cheesy baja, crisp lettuce, and melty cheese. It's just what you need for a perfect movie night. Get yourself some TLC, tender love and chicken, for only $1.99 at Sonic. Buy a $1.99 Sonic Crispy Chicken Tender Wrap today. Tax not included, limited time only at participating Sonic drive-ins.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. Are you tired of getting insanely high monthly bills from your wireless plan that includes unexpected overages? Well, here's a plot twist from Mint Mobile. For a limited time, their wireless plans are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/bigpick. That's mintmobile.com/bigpick. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
If you could recut any movie, Chris, the CR cut, what would it be?
This is a fucking awesome question. Den of Thieves, probably.
What? It's already perfect. What are you talking about?
I'd add on. I want the Benihana scene to be 40 minutes longer.
You know, I want
the Benihana scene to be in real time.
I don't want to derail us in this conversation because we have such strong momentum and I don't want to have to recut anything that we've done here, but garbage crime is growing, Chris.
I know.
The cult is growing. More and more people are saying that garbage crime...
Are you going to let me come on for talk about Little Things?
Yeah, of course. I want to do a 4-hour episode about The Little Things. The Little Things is the forthcoming Denzel Washington movie.
Yeah. What's Leto's character's name? Isn't it Albert Sparma?
That certainly sounds like the name of a character that he would play. It is Albert Sparma. Incredible job.
I already know the name of the serial killer in the Denzel Washington movie that isn't out yet.
Is he the serial killer?
I don't know.
That's the question.
We don't know.
It seems he is under suspicion. We'll have to watch. But as I say, garbage crime is growing because the people know. Have you been following the Netflix top 10 over the holidays?
Yeah. Every time it's just like 999 gets like, goes like, if any garbage crime hits Netflix, it just automatically goes into the top 10.
Yes. Ava, Unknown, uh-huh. The Liam Neeson film.
There's this Ryan Phillippe movie that Bill is very excited about called The Second.
It's all happening. I don't know why it's happening except for the fact that you and I made a podcast. That's the only reason I can think of as to why this is happening, but I'm just really excited about it.
I think we freed people up to feel comfortable with themselves.
Oh.
We taught people that it was okay to be weird.
Speaking of weird, there's something new happening with director's cuts. There's a new strand, a new strain, hopefully a safe strain. And I'm calling these strains the futurists. I don't know if that's going to feel like the right delineation. It might be more like the streamerists because it feels more common on these streaming services. But I've noticed a couple of examples. The first one that I saw was The Hateful Eight, Quentin Tarantino's 2015 Agatha Christie-esque Western. Mm-hmm. And it hit Netflix, I want to say 3-4 years ago. And the version of it that hit was chapterized and extended. And it was a longer movie, but it was organized on Netflix's streaming service like a miniseries. And that movie now, if you watch it, feels a lot more like all of the stuff that we saw in 2020, all of these miniseries, these Queen's Gambit style miniseries, than it did like the movie that I believe you and I saw together.
You and I went and saw the Roadshow together. Yeah.
Yes.
The overture and the intermission and everything.
Truly great screening of that film before it came out in 15. And the version that you can see now on Netflix is longer. And, you know, whether it's better or worse, I think is kind of immaterial. It's cool to see some added stuff. With a Tarantino movie, it's not hard to see what's new because the dialogue is so specific. But it certainly struck me as an innovation around the way that people are served movies. And we saw another version of this recently. I don't think you got the chance to see Dr. Sleep in movie
theaters. I actually just watched it over the break. Yeah, I just watched it over at Christmas, yeah.
So the version that you saw, I presume, was on HBO Max and was the director's cut.
It was, yeah.
What'd you think?
I haven't seen the original. So I think I texted you once and I was like, should I bother with Dr. Sleep? And I was like, I saw that there's a director's cut that's like 3+ hours long. And I think you said the director's cut was much better. I thought it was quite good. I thought and by all accounts, the Rebecca Ferguson character makes a shit ton more sense in the director's cut than in the original version.
But yeah.
Fascinating aspect of this is like, usually there's like an anniversary or there's a storied, this movie was taken away from Mike Flanagan and now 10 years later he gets to right the wrongs. This is the version that they put out on video essentially, and it, concurrent with like whatever other theatrical version came out, they immediately were like, Mike Flanagan's director's cut, as if it was always the plan.
Yes, I haven't heard anyone, including Flanagan, specifically explain why that rolled out the way that it did. I've talked about this a little bit. We had Gilbert Cruz on the show when the movie came out originally. Gilbert is a huge Stephen King fan and a scholar, really, in covering King's work. And we both, I think, were pretty medium on the movie. I think there were things that we liked. You know, you and I obviously really like Mike Flanagan's movies and his TV series. But something felt not quite right about the movie, sort of unfinished, really. And getting a chance to see the new version kind of revealed to me what it felt like the movie should have been. And yeah. I thought it worked a lot better as well. And the idea of just putting out the version that the filmmaker wanted to put out on a streaming service, and then most people seeing the movie that way, and then the theatrical cut being the thing that is lost to time instantaneously, is an amazing inversion. I love that idea of like the version that I saw in theaters and recorded a podcast about for posterity now doesn't make sense. No one's watching that version.
Yeah. So Flanagan is an interesting case where he's probably at this point best known for his Netflix horror series and for the Haunting of Hill House and the sequel that was The Turning of the Screw. I can't remember
The Haunting of Bly Manor. Yeah.
Both of which I would say are an episode or two too long. You know, that he has obviously settled into this, I can kind of push things and explore mood for 8 to 10 hours when maybe it could be six to seven hours. And so it's not surprising that Dr. Sleep, he would almost obviously would have rather have made a 4 or 5 episode Dr. Sleep than a 3-hour movie. This kind of brings up an interesting conversation though I wanted to have with you about, to the extent to which our viewing habits, and you and me, Amanda, often talk about like, and the great thing about it is it's only 1 hour and 45 minutes, you know, like that'll often be a selling point for a movie is its brevity. But how much of that do you think is like just been drilled into us? Because for most of our lives, we know that you go to a movie theater and the movie theater would like you to be out in about 2 hours. And it's only if the movie is somehow special that it would last that much longer than that. And that even when those movies are longer, like when you do have a Dark Knight Rises or, Tenet's quite long. If you do have one of these movies that is 2.5, 2 hours and 45 minutes, that is actually working against the film. That going into the movie, you're like, I can't believe this movie is this fucking long. Those habits and those behaviors are essentially like commercial realities. They're not necessarily for the best of the art that we're seeing, you know, like I'm curious to see whether or not as we go forward with streaming and there's less of a concern. In fact, for streamers, I'm sure they're like, look, if they want to hang out for 3.5 hours, that's just time spent for us. Like, I wonder whether or not we'll start to see more movies that feel less constrained by theatrical kind of restrictions?
I don't know. It's a good question. I've been thinking about this. You know, one of the most famous director's cuts, of which there are many iterations, is Das Boot, the Wolfgang Petersen U-boat film. And there are a number of different versions of it. I think the director's cut version is about 3.5 hours. But there is a version that aired on television, I think, in Europe that is about 400 minutes. And it's longer, and Petersen does not stand by that version. But that version came into existence because it made more sense for television as a kind of to be rolled out over a number of weeks. And it feels like that 400-minute version actually could become more common, where the extended version no longer signifies the director's vision. It signifies the thing that you need to maximize your streaming hours.
The Chernobyl cut. Yeah.
Yeah. We talked about that when Chernobyl came out, the idea that that would have been a 2.5-3 hour epic film in 1989. But instead, the version that we got was this 6-hour, I thought quite good, miniseries from Craig Mazin. But I don't know. I mean, is there a biological imperative to only want to be sitting in a seat for anywhere from 100 to 140 minutes and make that a meaningful film experience? And then anything beyond that feels stretched? It depends. I mean, it really depends on the kind of film that you're talking about.
First time I started thinking about that was Irishman, because people anecdotally were watching Irishman in sections.
You know, I don't want to say what film it is, but I saw a film that is coming out later this year recently, and it's a film based on a book, and the film is literally structured like the book, where every time we go to a new chapter, it reflects the chapter of the book, and the title of the chapter is like on screen. It's like chapter one prologue. And it did strike me that you could kind of like organize this movie, which I think was about maybe a 2-hour and 20-minute movie. You could organize it the same way you did The Hateful Eight, where it was, you clicked on the 25-minute intervals and you watched them through. And, you know, you and I have been talking about this ad nauseum for the last 12 months, just that the
collapsing line.
Yeah. It's all just content, for literally lack of a better word. We got to get a better word.
Content.
What's the word me and you can come up with something that isn't content.
If we do, we shouldn't give it away for free on this podcast.
What should we do with it?
Copyright it, be like Gary V, go out and just flip it, sell it, you know what I mean, make our dreams come true with it.
Was that an attempt to get Gary V to notice you? You want Gary V to invest in Chris Ryan Industries? I think that's what that was. So the futurists, I think that they're really the way forward for a lot of this stuff. I think you're right that you're going to see more stuff that is stretched, that is longer, that is chapterized, and maybe there is just learned behavior that is going to be broken by future generations.
I can't remember what it was, last year, 2 years ago, but the Dark Tower debacle and the idea that there was going to be a movie, a TV series that led to a sequel that concluded the story. I mean, like, they've been talking about trying to execute stories this way for a long time. I mean, in some ways, Breaking Bad kind of did that with El Camino, but like this idea that you could flit between the small screen and the big screen to tell the story that you want to tell, and that you could create this. And I think that they will do that to some extent with the Marvel and Star Wars Disney Plus stuff, and that there will be on-screen executions. I'm certain, for some reason, but like I feel pretty certain that there will be the Mandalorian will conclude on a big screen, that there will be like a final Mandalorian movie to wrap up the series. You know, that just seems inevitable to me. But you know, the thing that's so exciting and also probably is going to change the way we relate to these movies and whether or not we feel like this person economically and efficiently made their movie is the streamers, because it's just like Underground Railroad's going to come out and we're going to be like, what is this? You know what I mean? The same way that people were having a debate about Small Axe, like Underground Railroad is a cinematic statement by a singular director, one of our greatest directors. Are we going to call that a miniseries? Are we going to call it a TV series? Or is it just a thing?
Yeah, I heard you and Andy talking about this on The Watch this week, and I had the same thought. I feel like it's an even more discreet example of what is this, because Barry Jenkins is so clearly associated with cinema. That is, you know, he has gone to great lengths to make his work defined as such. And so the way you get it, I don't know if it defines it. We'll have to see. I think that a much more crude example of this that actually feels meaningful to me is, you know, there's a Godzilla versus King Kong movie coming out in a few months. Adam Wingard made a movie and it exists ostensibly in the same universe of Godzilla and King Kong movies we've been seeing over the last 10 years. Was it Gareth Edwards made a Godzilla movie?
Michael Dougherty,
Michael Dougherty made a Godzilla movie, and then the Kong Skull Island movie is also, you know, part of all of this.
Right.
But I don't think people know that, and I don't think that anyone understands that they are like trying to relaunch a universe that is like the MCU or Fast and the Furious. Like, they're just, and Godzilla movies are not really like, they're kind of ahistorical in many ways,
sure,
but and not chronological necessarily, but it's confusing. Like, it's confusing how to know, like, do I need to know, did you get a chance to see King of the Monsters or whatever the hell the last Godzilla movie was?
I didn't see it. No, I'd been pretty hyped to see it, but I did not actually wind up seeing it.
So I ask you that because I had a feeling that you didn't see it. So will you watch Godzilla versus King Kong?
Yeah. Well, I'm a big Adam Wingard fan, but
I know that about you.
I mean,
what if you miss all of the detail from King of the Monsters? I don't know. That's the joke I'm trying to make.
Did Ken Watanabe find like a girlfriend in one of these movies? Who cares?
remember when the Let Them Fight meme was happening?
That was really amazing.
That was one of the best memes. That seems like a reasonable place to pivot to the best versions of director's cuts. You and I have half-heartedly collaborated on a top five here because it's hard to know what to invest your time in and why. And most of these that we're going to talk about are quite long. This was a much more arduous, or at least much more significant time commitment than research for other episodes of this show, because the existing versions are very long.
Yeah.
And in some cases, manifold. For example, the first in our top five, which is Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
There are a bunch of different versions of this.
It's never the wrong time to watch Apocalypse Now, and I'm never mad at watching all of Apocalypse Now.
But so, good segue there. Which version? Because in 2001, much like George Lucas reissuing the Star Wars films, Francis Ford Coppola reissued Apocalypse Now as Apocalypse Now Redux.
Yes.
You could go see this film. And in many ways, this to me is the signature director's cut, because it is a much different film. Mm-hmm. Than the original film. It features an entire plot line that was not in the original. The original was already understood while it was a tumultuous and difficult production and almost, you know, felled his career. It's also one of the greatest movies ever made. And yet, he still felt compelled to go back and insert this storyline about this French family, these colonizers who have been living in Vietnam for many years, and they represent essentially
they kind of don't know the war zone, like that they've lost.
Yeah. They're trapped in this amber of time, and they also represent sort of the reason why the war is ongoing, because they have, you know, planted their flag in this foreign country and attempted to own it, to take it over. And it's a very slow, I guess about 20 to 35 minutes, right in the middle of the movie, and it kind of stops the movie dead in its tracks, but conceptually, it does help the movie make its point.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like Redux? Do you like where the movie is now, which is Apocalypse Now Final Cut, which came out in 2019? Like, what is
the
version?
So, what did Final Cut
like?
Add on? I think Redux is, this is a really good example. Redux is beautiful, and I personally love the French colony because I think it hammers home, as Coppola says in Hearts of Darkness, which is Eleanor Coppola's movie about the making of Apocalypse Now, her documentary. He's like, I wanted it to feel like these guys were going back in time. So they start, they've got the kind of contemporary, the Playboy bunnies and everything happening. And then as they go down the river, they're going back in time so that they go to the colonial era, and then they go almost to this primitive era once they get to Kurtz's compound. So I thought it hammered home that feeling. And I think when you have a movie that looks as good as Apocalypse Now and sounds as good as Apocalypse Now and has the performers in it, I would actually just watch that movie for as long as he wanted to have it go. Like, there's no limit to Apocalypse Now in my mind, but I don't think he doesn't significantly change it. And the only thing that I think really I want more of that there isn't of is Scott Glenn, is the guy who goes before Willard. And I just wish there was an entire movie about him.
Did you check out Scott Glenn on WTF recently?
No, is he good?
It's incredible. Highly recommend. Yeah, so as far as what is in the final cut, it cuts out the Playmates sequence.
The second one.
Yes.
Yeah.
The sort of the sex with the Playmates, the stuff that's happening, I think, in a van. But it keeps Colonel Kilgore's surfboard, mm-hmm. and it keeps the French plantation. So it's kind of a fusion of Redux and the original cut of the film. And I think it's 3 hours on the nose. And I remember it being good. I watched it when it came out and bought the Blu-ray like a chump. And that's, as you pointed out, like, this, I probably own four different DVD or Blu-ray copies of Apocalypse Now.
Yeah.
And some of this is a financial gambit, but some of it just seems like Coppola is obsessed. Nevertheless, it's the kind of thing that I think it is a rare case where thinking about understanding and watching all of the different iterations of the movie and the ancillary content surrounding the movie helps you enjoy it more, mm-hmm. helps you feel differently about it and understand what the filmmaker was going for. So that's Apocalypse Now. Speaking of many cuts, as you pointed out, there are many cuts of Blade Runner.
Yeah.
The final cut is the one that is probably most popular, as you said, and the one that most people have seen, and I think is the best one. This is also a movie that it seems like people disagreed about behind the scenes about what it should do and how it should be released. The original version has a happy ending. The final cut does not have a happy ending. The final cut insinuates that the Harrison Ford character, that Decker, is a replicant pretty clearly, mm-hmm. whereas the original version does not indicate that. There is no voiceover in the final cut. There are like significant changes that change the movie. And for whatever reason, it took Ridley Scott a long time to get the opportunity to make the version he wanted to make. You're a big Blade Runner allegiant. Which do you prefer? What story do you like?
I definitely prefer the final cut. I don't need the unicorn sequence personally. I think it's a little bit, it takes you out of the movie a little bit. And I liked not knowing whether Deckard was a replicant or not. And obviously 2049 addresses that a little bit more explicitly. I think the huge, huge thing is the voiceover. It was obviously inserted by people who felt like the movie wasn't clear enough at the studio. Harrison Ford does the voiceover the way I do some ad reads on podcasts. You know, he's like, I was a killer. It was a good job, but it, you know, whatever. Los Angeles and it's 2021. You know, like it was definitely like, it sounded like he had a gun to his head when he was making it. And the very last scene in the theatrical cut is nonsense. And it's great to have them just going out the door and closing. I mean, it's like Casablanca.
Yeah, it's not a sad ending. It's just ambiguous, which is, yeah, that's part of what makes it great. I agree. I definitely think the final cut is worth watching if you're going to watch just one Blade Runner cut. Heaven's Gate, I mentioned. I think it's probably the most significant, not just because of what it meant to the studio, but because there's some amazing filmmaking in it.
And unbelievable.
It's a unique version, I think, of something that tends to happen in Hollywood and that, frankly, jerks like me are guilty of, which is talking about the production of the movie as opposed to talking about the movie.
I don't care. When you want to tell me about Michael Cimino walking on set one day and being like, I need the two sides of the street to be 6 feet farther apart. And he's like, so just tear the town down and rebuild it.
I actually think that's great.
I love it. Michael Cimino waiting all day because there's a cloud he likes and he wants to see if it will roll closer to his camera. Absolutely. I'm here for it.
Do you think that a movie like this, if it rolled out, and Cimino, I think his first cut was like 5 hours, mm-hmm. and the version that you can watch now from Criterion is 3.5 hours. If it had been rolled out, say, the way that The Hateful Eight was rolled out on a streaming service over four episodes, because the film is very episodic. You know, it's not a clear through line narratively. It bounces from, you know, this incredible opening sequence set at Harvard, and then it moves to Wyoming, and then it, you know, there's battle sequences, and then there's these sort of more, these elegant dance sequences and the roller skating sequence. It does feel like a series of impressionistic pieces capturing a period in time and mm-hmm. the disagreements and the natural kind of battle lines that are drawn.
Yeah, it's a class war too. Yeah.
Totally. If it had been rolled out in sections, do you think something like this could be successful or popular? Because it is one of the most notorious bombs in the history of Hollywood.
Yeah, I think that it's unfairly maligned. Like a lot of stuff from the 70s and early 80s, like I just think that like even bad movies from that period are pretty interesting, you know? But I think that ultimately this was a guy who viewed himself as at the top of a kind of pyramid. And that included the audience. The audience were beneath him. And it was in his opinion that the audience, if they sat through Deer Hunter, they're going to sit through Heaven's Gate and they should come and experience his vision of the American West in the 19th century. And, you know, could Criterion Channel start experimenting with putting these films up in sections? I suppose so. I mean, you can watch Berlin Alexanderplatz in that way. If you know, it's not like there aren't great works by filmmakers that were originally ideated for television or miniseries form. Ingmar Bergman did that too.
Fanny and Alexander, I think, is like one of the most significant versions of this, where there's a TV version and then there's the cinema cut, and they're both interesting and they're both useful.
But to me, Heaven's Gate is death by cinema. To me, Heaven's Gate is, this guy's career ended over this. You should watch it the way he intended you to see it.
Yeah, it's true.
I think it's a pretty good movie. I wouldn't watch it more than once every 7 or 8 years. Like, it's not like I don't watch this like the way I would watch like Heat, but it's pretty gorgeous and the performances are pretty amazing.
It is. There are certain things about it that don't work. I think there's some misbegotten Isabelle Huppert positioning in the movie in general. But I think she is good in the film. Chris Christopherson is good in the film. Christopher Walken is great in the movie. Sam Waterston is great in the movie. John Hurt. It's a really great cast at a perfect time. There are a couple of battle set pieces at the end of the film that are great. I think the movie is kind of best through its first 2 hours. And I think that's one of the reasons why it was maligned somewhat, is that critics got to hour three and they were just like, Jesus Christ. But then you overlook the majesty, like the incredible work that he does in that extravagant dance sequence at Harvard at the beginning of the movie, or in the roller skating sequence, which is just breathtaking. So, you know, it's definitely a movie that is worth watching.
It's also came out at an era, which is probably a whole other conversation, where American film critics were more openly adversarial about the things that they were seeing and regularly panned quite good movies, you know, because they didn't feel that they lived up to their bar that they had set for art. And now I think we have a much more encouraging, shall I say, like critical voice in, you know, the American arts. Like, it's much more like, they did it with Wonder Woman, another rollicking, like, great time. And it's like, it wasn't that extraordinary to see Ball and Kale come out and see like a very, very, very good movie and be like, this was shit, you know? And so I think a movie like Heaven's Gate, if it came out today in the format that you're talking about, or in any other format, would probably have more supporters than it did back when it was released. And that's a thing that surrounds a lot of these films from the 70s and 80s, where they had just a lot more going against them in a lot of ways, despite the fact that I think audiences were a little bit more adventurous.
Do you know what your dad thought of Heaven's Gate?
I don't. I think he would probably, knowing him, would have been like, this movie is too long. He was a very big, I mean, for as much as he, you know, I remember my first long movie experience was him taking me to the re-release of Lawrence of Arabia and me asking to leave because there was too much riding. I was like, these guys just are riding across the desert. And I think my dad almost wanted to disown me at that point. Obviously, Lawrence of Arabia is one of the greatest movies ever made. But as a 11-year-old, I think I was just like, this sucks, you know? But yeah, he was not a huge, I want to be in a movie. He was seeing four movies a week. I don't think he was like, I really want to be in this theater for 3.5 hours.
Right. That makes sense.
My dad was a big like leave before the end credits started. He would be like, I got it, and then walk out.
He would have a really hard time with the MCU then, you know, missing all those stingers.
No stingers for him.
So you wanted to talk about The Abyss.
Yeah, I think that this is probably goes well with Blade Runner in that the cuts that were made to it. So there are two big Cameron director's cuts, I think, worth mentioning. One is Aliens that adds an entire sequence with Newt's family and LV-426 or 246.
I don't know if I've ever seen that.
Oh, it's pretty cool. It's on HBO Max. Okay. So for people who want to check it out. And the director's cut is on HBO Max. And it basically is the movie, except it has a 15-minute sequence of the colonists that they go eventually find destroyed by the aliens. And it shows Newt's family discovering the hive, basically. So you meet her before you meet... And it's actually... sucks. Like, I think meeting Newt the way you meet it in Aliens, it doesn't suck. Like, it's an incredibly well-made sequence, but the fact that you meet this kid who has been living like a feral existence when Ripley gets to the planet,
right,
is a better
awesome. Introduction. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that. And then Abyss, The Abyss, it spends a lot more time with Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and Ed Harris's relationship. So I think you're a lot more invested in the characters of those two people. And it also has a pretty significantly different ending, which I don't want to spoil for people, but The Abyss is one where, again, Cameron, like one of the most successful filmmakers of all time, has a version of, I guess Abyss is probably one of his less successful movies, if I think it's probably one of his better regarded films, but has a much different version of it in existence.
I rewatched The Abyss recently on HBO Max. So I assume is the version that's there.
Let me see.
The longer version. That's the other thing that's confusing about this is some of these things are properly identified. And
right. And
are
some
not.
Aren't. Yeah. It's so cool that all the Cameron stuff is on HBO Max.
It's wild. He is somebody though, too, who I don't think has necessarily been properly not supported by home video, but there's not, it's not clear necessarily what is what.
Yeah.
In his, because with Aliens, for example, I own a version of that from the box set, the Alien Quadrilogy.
Yeah.
For like True Lies, you can't buy on Blu-ray, I think. I think it's still unavailable on Blu-ray, which I don't know what the reason for that is. Terminator 2, there is a director's cut of Terminator 2, and there have been a number of different releases of that movie and the original.
He's a big
as well.
Remasterer.
Yes. What about the all of the films that inspired him after The Abyss about him going underwater with Bill Paxton and looking at ghosts in the sea? Have you watched those?
Those director's cuts of those movies, yeah.
Maybe that's a separate pod for us. James Cameron goes into the water. That's a pretty good. That'd be a good pod.
James Cameron invents his own fire retardant foam.
I'm going to clear out now. It's your time to shine. The final director's cut in our top five is a film called Kingdom of Heaven.
Ridley Scott.
Oft joked about between you and I and on this podcast at times, but I think is a bit of a curio to most people. What is Kingdom of Heaven? Why does it matter to you? And why is the director's cut important?
So Kingdom of Heaven is a movie in 2005 that Ridley Scott released starring Orlando Bloom that's about the Crusades. It's about a guy, a bastard knight in France who hooks up with reunites with his father, played by Liam Neeson, and goes to Jerusalem and winds up fighting against both the Muslims who are there and also some of the Templar Knights who are essentially like fanatical Christians who are trying to start a war with the Muslims there. And in its original version, I think it's like 2 hours, 20 minutes or something. And it was regarded as sub gladiator sword and shield bullshit with a bad central performance from Orlando Bloom. And it kind of came and went. Not too long after that, a roadshow version of it, I think it debuted at like the Lamley or something like out here. And it wound up becoming the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven. And it's about 3.5 hours long, I believe. I think maybe a little longer. And I honestly will say this, and everybody is going to piss on my grave for saying it. It's basically McCabe and Mrs. Miller meets Lawrence of Arabia. It is so fucking awesome. It's got this hour long sequence in the beginning, basically, that is explains who Orlando Bloom's character is and like why he is running from France. And his brother is played by Michael Sheen, who's like a priest. And there's this whole thing with his wife's suicide and she's going to go to hell. So he's got to go to Jerusalem to get absolution for her and for him. And it sets up like the relationship between Orlando Bloom and Liam Neeson's character much more clearly. And there's like a lot more time spent with the characters. And essentially once you settle into the rhythms of it, you get the magisterial, like, you know, upper 99th percentile of filmmakers when you get to Ridley Scott in terms of technical ability and proficiency. And then you get this lovely, beautiful historical epic written by William Monahan, much more time spent with like Edward Norton's King, who Edward Norton is a uncredited performer in this movie where he plays a leper king who wears like a metal mask the entire time. I think it's honestly like one of like the hidden gems of this past 20 years of movie making. I don't know how many people have had a chance to see it, but I don't know many people who have seen the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven who don't love it.
If Gladiator had never come out, if there was no such movie as Gladiator, but there was a Kingdom of Heaven, would it have been properly recognized in its time? And was this like fatigue from a certain kind of movie from Scott?
No, because I don't see the thing with Gladiator is Gladiator had catchphrases. Gladiator was a very easily understandable movie, a general who became a slave who became a legend. Like that was the arc of Gladiator. And it was just like, you could explain that, you can show it at Staples Center. Like Kingdom of Heaven is about like, you know, fate and destiny and also about like religious fundamentalism on both sides and how Jerusalem becomes this like chess piece between these two warring factions of absolutists and how really what needs to conquer is humanism. I mean, that's not, I don't think it's as easily translatable.
Where is Kingdom of Heaven for you in the, we've not done the Ridley Scott
power rankings.
Pretty
episode.
High up there. I mean, I think Alien and Blade Runner are kind of like in a category of their own. And I think that there are some movies that he's made that I think are technically like just mind blowing. Like Black Hawk Down is still like, I think you watch that movie and you're just like, there's only like one or two people who could ever made a movie like this. I just don't know whether or not people are even like watching Black Hawk Down anymore for social and political reasons. And maybe that's a good thing. But yeah, Kingdom of Heaven's probably top five or six for me.
I have had more thrilling and disappointing experiences at Ridley Scott movies, I think, than any movie ever. Like any filmmaker ever. The first time I sat down and we watched Robin Hood together, I was like, how can this have happened? How could you have hurt me in this way? Yeah. Same thing with Exodus, Gods and Kings. I'm like, how could you have hurt me this deeply? Conversely, movies that I don't think I'm going to like G.I. Jane or Matchstick Men, I thought were great.
Yeah.
And he's so unpredictable. We have two Ridley Scott movies coming out in 2021. Are you aware of this?
Yes, I am. The Last Duel and Gucci, right?
Yes. There's a Gucci film coming from Ridley Scott. Which of the two?
Also, Ridley Scott is like 100 years old, right?
I don't think that's the exact age he is. I think he's 83.
Yes.
Protect Ridley
Scott.
He's
making two movies a year at 83. What are we doing?
How many pods have you made today, Chris?
That's true. This is true.
You are the Ridley Scott of podcasting, I must say. Anything else you want to say about director's cuts? I feel like we've given people a good starting off point if you want to start getting into this world of intense movie fandom.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, this is sort of on the spot. Is there a director's cut that you would like to see? Is there a movie out there where you're like, I heard this got taken away from this person or that they had to recut this and I wonder what the actual version of it is and all that. Like, is there a movie out there that you would love to see a director's cut of?
Well, the most famous version of that is The Magnificent Ambersons, right? That's the Orson Welles follow-up to Citizen Kane that very few people have seen and that is no longer in existence. The negative is gone and there's no way to see it. There is a version that is significantly shortened and the tone is quite different. That would be one. And for a long time, it was Touch of Evil before Walter Murch, who you mentioned earlier, returned to the negative of Touch of Evil and cleaned that up and restored that film and got out the version that Welles wanted out in the world. I'm trying to think of something a little bit more recent.
Mine is Rogue One.
Oh.
Which is quite, is only growing in our estimation as the years go by and we see other Star Wars stuff. We're like, actually, Rogue One was about as good as it gets.
But isn't that kind of an inversion? Don't people seem to think that Tony Gilroy came in and saved that movie from what it was going to be?
I do think that that's true, but I think that there is a version of Rogue One that has a lot less, like, we have to run to this planet to find out a useless piece of information. And I wonder whether or not there's stuff on the cutting room floor. And I also wonder what I would love to see, like, what's Gareth Edwards' assembly of that movie? Like, at what point did he get removed? What scenes did Tony... Like, I think it would be really cool if down the line you could see the Gareth Edwards cut and the Tony Gilroy cut of that movie.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I mean, that is... There are some movie experiences that replicate that. You know, Alien 3, of course, the Fincher movie, there's an assembly cut of that movie available that somewhat approximates what Fincher was going for, though does not completely show his vision of the movie. There's a really good, I'm trying to think of just other director's cuts I love in lieu of something that I've always wanted to see. I mean, Amadeus has a great director's cut that has like an additional 30 minutes of the movie, and that's an extremely long film that is quite good.
Trying to think of stuff that's recent. I mean, like, the stuff that recently you would think like needs a director's cut is more stuff that was a disaster, you know, like
Detective Pikachu.
Well, or like The Dark Phoenix, you know?
You just blanked me on my Pikachu joke.
Dark Phoenix.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, is there even a version of that movie that could be good?
I doubt it, you know? I don't even know if they have the footage.
That's the thing. There's a fine line between, you know what, we just screwed up this movie and we didn't put the movie on screen that we had in the can. And there's something tricky there, but I think that we're going to see a lot more versions of director's cuts. We might just not be calling them director's cuts. We'll be calling them something different in the future. CR, thanks for doing this, man. It's always good to chat with you about movies.
My pleasure.
Please stay tuned to The Big Picture in the future. Amanda will be back later this week, and we will be talking about the most anticipated movies of 2021. We'll definitely hear some Ridley Scott. There'll be a whole lot more. See you then.